Started and start with introductions. So, hi, I'm Teresa Bernstein, Director of Department Licensing.
Jim Johnson, representing Walla Walla County Commissioner, representing Association of Counties.
Good morning, John Weisman. I work as the Secretary of Health.
I thought we were all doing drop cover cold.
We did.
You're 15 years late.
You died real quick.
We're pulling you out of the rug.
I'm Mike Dornfeld. I'm representing Roger Millar from the Department of Transportation.
Darren Rendell, Director of Traffic Safety Commission.
Glenn Gorton. I'm the Director of Student Transportation for the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, representing Chris Reichdahl.
I'm Rosemary Sepola. I represent the Association of Washington Cities, and I'm a city council member from Kalama, Washington.
Jeff Sass, Washington State Patrol Assistant Chief. John Matisse.
Nicole around the room.
Bob Thompson with the commission.
Edna Fisco, the traffic safety.
I'm Catherine Boyd. I'm the project manager and lead writer for Target Zero.
Angie Ward, program manager, traffic safety commission.
Amy Davignon, State Department of Health with motor vehicle injury prevention.
Donita Prumman, Department of Transportation.
Pam Hancock, Washington Traffic Safety Commission.
I'm Mark McDowell, Traffic Safety Commission.
Wes Rethel, Lewis County Sheriff's Office.
Billy Rimmer, the Division of Behavioral Health and Recovery at the Health Care Authority.
Scott Waller, Traffic Safety Commission.
Shelley Baldwin, Traffic Safety Commission.
Bo Birchbacher, Department of Licensing.
Rob Snows, Lewis County Sheriff's Office.
Rachel Simmons, Jones, Traffic Safety Commission. Wonderful.
All right, so approval of minutes for 4:19 and 7:19.
Unfortunately, we do not have a quorum.
Oh, okay.
So we have 10 members, 6 makes a quorum.
Okay.
So we're just a bit shy today.
All right. So I take it that means we skip that?
We will move it to the January calendar.
Excellent.
Well, we know all of you will be here.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
Okay, great. Then let's get into Target Zero Plan Partners meeting, Catherine.
Where's a good place for me to sit? Just up here.
Okay.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. As I mentioned in my introduction, I'm the project manager and lead writer for Target Zero. It's my pleasure to be here to present today. My goal is just to give you a quick update on where we are with the project. I presented with you guys in July at the last meeting, and we haven't really gotten things off the ground yet, so we've got some substantial progress so far, and several people in the room have been part of this process, and I welcome them to weigh in if I miss any details or if I got questions that are a little bit beyond my capacity. In the interim, you might remember last time I was here, I was pregnant. In the interim, I'm not pregnant any longer. I do have a lovely little boy. He's in Seattle today. Sorry, I couldn't bring him. He makes me think a lot harder about traffic safety because I got a very precious cargo in my car now. So I want to talk with you about the partner meeting, the plans outlined and signed, and then the data of the plan. So we set the partner meeting for December 13th. It's at Great Wolf Lodge where we hold the last one. We have 200 total spaces, and the last time I checked, which was earlier this week, 160 of them were filled. So we're planning to get to 200, and if we go beyond that, we'll have to talk about what happens next if we want to expand expand the space, because we got people who are interested in being part of this conversation. That's important. So the focus is committing to specific solutions as a partnership. The crisis that we have right now is that traffic deaths and serious injuries are rising. The opportunity this creates is for some really critical conversations around what do? We've picked the low-hanging fruit. We've taken on the things that are easy. We've made those successes, but it's not enough. And so this prompts what we're hoping is a soul-searching conversation on what we could and should do as a partnership. We have 6 breakout sessions planned. Local efforts, policy barriers, licensing requirements, autonomous vehicles, communicating about Target Zero, and then multicultural outreach. That one we're still fleshing out. It was a new addition to our list. In the policy barriers, I just got word from Darren and Pam and Wade that we are going to talk about sobriety checkpoints as well as cameras, so traffic cameras that automatically check your speed. So those are two controversial topics, but again, in the face of rising deaths and injuries, they're things that I think we could and should consider. So Darren, Pam, did you have anything you wanted to say on that, or did I cover it?
No, from my perspective, I think it's, you know, we shouldn't shy away from these difficult conversations. And the more we talk about it, the more of an awareness we can raise on the importance of continuing to pursue this.
So when you look at sobriety checkpoints or a form thereof, depending upon some of the research and outcomes, they've seen anywhere from a 9 to almost 30% reduction in fatal crashes. So the intent isn't necessarily to make lots of arrests. The intent is to deter and have people really think about alternatives to drinking. So that's one thing. And what we're seeing, too, from a lot of our partners, especially in like Lyft, Uber, and some of those other forms of transportation, is just take Lyft to your event. If you're going to plan to drink, start from there. And then you don't have to worry about, should I take my car or not? So just thinking about different ways of helping people make better decisions, especially around if they're going to be consuming alcohol or if they are going to be consuming certain types of drugs, that they have an alternative. So
we developed this in conjunction with the project team, which represents many different agencies, tribes. So we've had a lot of hands in the development of the partner meeting. But if people have an interest or want to learn more about this, I'm happy to answer any questions about what the partner meeting will look like, who we think is going to be there. Do folks have any questions right now? Hopefully you can all make it. And we'll have four speakers. Roger Millar, I think, is RSVP'd. Teresa Berenson from the Department of Licensing.
She's right here.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry.
Your science turn.
So I forgot. I apologize.
There's a reason for that.
Yeah, that's right. And Darren's going to speak. So thank you for RSVPing. Darren's going to speak. And then Chief Batiste is unable to make it, so he's sending a representative.
That's graduation that day.
That's right.
The chief and I don't get to miss graduation.
Yeah, I think it's Captain Jason Lynn from District 5, Vancouver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we've also developed an outline. This is the high level. So it's pretty similar to what we had in the 2016 edition. So we'll be grouping certain categories under high-risk behavior, some under crash type, some under road users. So high-risk behavior might be impairment, speeding. Crash type is run off the road or intersections. And then road users are young users, old users, bicyclists, and pedestrians. And then we're going to have a focus in the beginning on the rising deaths and serious injuries, and we're going to talk pretty succinctly about why that's happening and what we are committing to do to reverse those trends. Any questions on the plan outline? We're still working on the design, but here's some new content we are thinking. So like a broad overview of the upward trend, looking at behavioral health and prevention, and that might be something that you might be interested in. Sorry, your name just went right out of my head. I had a baby. That's my excuse for everything right now. But I was like, can you remind me of your name?
John
Weisman. I'm sorry, thank you. Yeah, and Amy Davignon, and then in the way back there.
Billy Reamer,
yeah, from behavioral health. Now you're not at DSHS anymore, you're now at H Healthcare Authority?
Correct.
We had a little section on vehicle technology last time. In the 3 years between that plan and this plan, autonomous vehicles have taken on quite a new presence in the conversation, so we're going to have a chapter on them. We're going to look at rural versus urban crashes and the differences between those and how we might have different countermeasures. And we're also going to have an increased focus on Vision Zero as a partner.
Could you just talk a little bit about the health equity and what do you think?
Yeah. So my understanding of this is that there's populations that are disproportionately impacted by crashes, and we wanted to talk a little bit about how we identify those populations and reach out to them. So, and there's a few folks from the Safety Commission and also the Department of Health. So Paula Reeves, the Department of Health, is going to be tentatively tapped to be the lead writer on that chapter.
We've been to several conferences now, especially the one that in Seattle a couple years ago, spent a tremendous amount of time talking about distracted driving, sleep deprivation, all that sort of thing. Where does that fit in here? Is that behavioral health?
So those will fall under high-risk behavior.
Okay.
And we did have chapters on those last time, but the research and the understanding continues to evolve.
Right, right.
So, actually, Angie Ward wrote the distracted driving chapter last time, and I'm not sure who's on the point for that this time. But
Erica Mascaro.
Erica Mascaro, okay. So we're going to be bringing in the latest information and data and the latest understanding of countermeasures.
To me, it kind of goes with the autonomous vehicles, trucking, the shortage of trucking, qualified drivers, on and on and on. It seems to me it's kind of all kind of morphing together.
Yeah. I think one of the big answers to driver distraction is, and it's something like 90% of all collisions are caused by some type of driver error or have that as a factor. If you remove the person behind the wheel, you would dramatically reduce crashes. So,
but yes. You'd have to take all of us off the road at that point.
Yeah.
Or we're sitting there reading a book.
I would say that one of the things I've heard from a lot of the people around the table is to not act like autonomous vehicles are the answer to everything.
Right.
And Daniela, who's here today to speak, I'm not sure on autonomous vehicles, but she's in the autonomous vehicle unit at WashDOT, so she might be able to answer some questions too. But there's a tentativeness about like making that the holy grail or the magic bullet to the solution. It'll be years before those cars are on the road and are fully on the road, and even years as they penetrate the fleet and become the de facto form of transportation. So I think there will be some discussion on how this is part of the future, part of the prevention, but not the only way we get to zero.
So just hold for just a second here. You know, with our pedestrian advisory councils and our bicycle safety advisory councils, is each of those have kind of identified an issue around this kind of almost health and safety equity, where in some of the more affluent areas, they have more of the facilities, sidewalks, you know, that make it more, you know, conducive for bicycling and walking. And you look at some areas where maybe there hasn't been those investments, and they may be where those are, we've been seeing is kind of the marginalized communities, some of the lower end, as far as the socioeconomic area, is how do we look at transportation planners and city planners to help look at some of those areas to improve the safety? Because there is a lot of crashes, particularly in those areas. Is it all just engineering? Or is it behavior, or both? And can we improve those to help separate vehicles and non-vehicles?
Well, in most transportation grant programs, the thing they will not fund are sidewalks.
Mm-hmm. So
they do not fund sidewalks in transportation grant safety grant programs that most communities go out for. It is money. And the stormwater and the engineering and everything goes with it. It is not just throw a sidewalk up there and everybody's happy.
Right. So that's those. But it's kind of looking at this thing holistically. So I think that's part of this health equity I just wanted to really address, because I think sometimes those are things that really get overlooked.
Then I'm hoping Darren and we'll touch on it a little bit later. And I just had a very brief conversation with Angie for the meeting, that we can expand that into licensure and all the stuff we do over at DOL too, where it's kind of a pay to play.
Right. You know, and I think that's the other element of this is when and maybe it's not necessarily health equity,
right.
But if there's an equity as far as you look at the number of young drivers that are waiting to get their license until they're 18 or 19, and then they're not required to go through the driver's school, which then could impact their skill levels and all of that. So it all has kind of this mishmash. So I think as Commissioner Cipolla said,
it's all about the money, ultimately, a lot of it.
Yeah. So.
Or lack of it. Black girl.
Yes.
Okay. I did just want to talk, get into the data conversation briefly. So this is what the trend looks like right now. So if I wanted to, I realized I didn't get the legend in here, but this orange line represents what we need to do to get to zero. The black dotted line represents the trend right now, and that blue area is the space between. So in the last time we did this plan, most of those gaps were very small. They were, you know, little acute angles, and now they're getting bigger. They're like Pac-Man. And almost all of the emphasis areas will have that type of a graph, unfortunately. So just highlighting some of the difficulties we have in visually presenting this information, too. You know, so I think the last part of this is about some data in the plan. So there's some suggested changes that are under review. I'm going to take those to the co-sponsors next week. So they do revolve to some degree around licensure, around the definition of what a motorcycle is, around bikes and pedestrians. And so you might see some small changes in there, but nothing major. And they will go through several levels of approval before they actually get incorporated into the plan. That's what I had to say. Did folks have any questions for me on the work that we've done recently?
Well, I just want to thank you because this is a monumental undertaking. And, you know, every 3 years we redo this plan, and there's a lot of stuff that goes into this, from the data, from the project teams, the steering committee, looking at this from different perspectives, bringing the partners in, getting some thoughts and perspectives on that, what's happening at a national level, incorporating countermeasures that work, and then trying to have the chapters represent so much information in a very succinct way. So it takes a lot of us to do that. So thanks for taking the lead on this and willing to stand there and, you know, take the shots, that sort of thing. Right. So
it's my pleasure. It's one thing I would say is this is such a mature effort, and I'm building on the work of many, many people who've come before me, and that is a tremendous help. This afternoon, I'm actually going to DSHS to talk with them about Target Zero, and they're considering adopting a similar aspirational target, and they want to know, well, how does it work? What are the pitfalls? How do you do it? And it's a pleasure to be able to talk about this and the work that others have done and how we get to build on that to improve our state, improve the lives that we live and the lives of the people around us live. So thank you for the privilege.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, if I might, Madam Chair, is looking at commissioned agencies and even association cities, counties, is how are we incorporating the Target Zero into our own organizations?
Yes.
Is it mentioned in our plans, in our strategic plans? And though it may not necessarily relate to Target Zero in some areas, those areas that do, you know, how are we incorporating that in those countermeasures and some of those elements so that as commissioners, you are all, you know, showing that not only do you have your signature in the book, but you've applied it. And I think licensing is a good example. DOT is a good example of some of the things that have been done around the Target Zero aspect. So OSPI, make sure that you're blaring that loud and
yes.
With all your school bus drivers.
Yes.
So, thank
Wonderful.
You.
Wonderful. Okay. So we're going to talk about the 2019 legislative session. And we're DOL's first up on the agenda. I was hoping I could kind of start us out by having just a conversation. With these mics in front of us, it feels really formal, but I'm hoping to put that aside and just talk about something. So when I started in July, we were talking about potentially two pieces of agency request legislation on DOL regarding Target Zero. One was water cycle safety, and the other was young drivers. And I have made the difficult tentative decision to not move forward with the young driver piece of legislation. And I want to just have a really frank discussion about why. So as most of you, as all you all know, we're Washington seems like we're always saying we're unique, right? But we have an interesting situation where we have a quasi-privatized drivetrain school model, right? And this happened, I don't know, what, 8 years ago, Bo? More?
Yeah, it was, around 11, 12?
Yeah, something about right. Yeah. So, you know, our situation is, so the department licensing, you know, gives you the stamp of approval if you are qualified to drive. And we do that, but the training is, back in the day when I went to school, you know, I paid $50 and my shop teacher told me how to drive, right? And I had a lot of time on the road and it was something, right? And now, you know, I have two teenage stepkids, God help me, and, you know, we just, you know, it's about, when all is truly said and done, with the permits and the licenses, you're forking out about $800-$900 to put a kid through drive training school, to get the permit, the tests, you know, and there's all kinds of different models. So what we talked about, it's interesting as an agency director, because in a world where everything's urgent, we literally will talk about sometimes, is someone gonna die if we don't do this, right? And then we start talking about Target Zero, and the answer is yes. So this is where stuff gets real, you know. So what we were thinking of proposing was that, so right now under current law, the premise is you magically know how to drive at 18. Yeah, last time I checked, not happening. So the premise was that we have all this amazing data in Target Zero that says if we trained people, you know, really everybody to be a first-time driver, but let's start with young drivers, so we started with the 18 to 25, that serious injuries and deaths would go down. Here's the deal with that, though. Just because you pass a law saying mandating something doesn't mean it happens. And so what we were thinking about is, given the model I just discussed, it has a huge financial impact on families to now require dry training school for 18 to 25. And it's not just the pure money, it's the time, right? And we had a discussion at the last meeting from a couple persons spoke up about, like, what does 50 hours mean in the car? Should we be requiring more? Who has the time to do that and who doesn't? So then we talked about a subsidy model for low-income persons to be able to get a subsidy for drive training school. And then we talked about how to fund that. That's the part where I don't think we have it figured out yet. I think we need to have a more in earnest conversation about the social equity issues of paying for this requirement. If a subsidy is the right way to go, how we fund that subsidy, and if it has disproportionate impact. So I'll be quiet now and ask for discussion. So that's where I'm headed, is that I don't think we're quite ready to propose this in legislation this year. And again, my sidebar with Angie, I know that in Target Zero coming out, we're talking about discussing licensure in a little bit of different way. And I think that will help inform it. And I think talking to some of our health partners and getting in some more financial people would be a good thing. Thoughts? Disappointed?
So was the impetus for the legislation just simply that for anyone to get a license, regardless of age, you'd have to have some, go through some training program?
We're going to start 25. We're going to start with up to 25, right? And no magic answer to why, right?
Well, part of it was the data shows.
But right, exactly.
It drops off 25.
Sure.
Very dramatically.
Yeah. So that makes sense. Okay.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And there's no way it's ever going back to the schools.
Pardon me?
There's no way it's ever going back to the schools.
Oh, anything's possible.
Is that a rhetorical question?
Yeah, asking. No, I mean, it's a great question, seriously.
I mean,
it begs the question.
Yeah.
A policy was put in place, and
that policy's generated from...
Well, it's legislation.
I mean, right. Did the school districts come to the legislature and say, we don't have enough time with everything else we're doing to teach kids to drive, or what? Because when my oldest daughter went, she's 32, she actually learned it, and I did pay $100, and she did go like an hour early to school and had the instructor, you know, PE teacher.
The schools were always, they had quite a bit of funding to go along with it, and when all the funding went away,
and where did the
it made it very
why
difficult.
Did the funding go away?
That was back in 02 and 03 and things.
Well, that's only 50. Come on, man. You don't have menopause. I can't remember things. You should be all right. You know, where'd it go? Where'd the money go? Did we not have it? Was it a recession? Did they decide they didn't want to do it anymore? I mean,
Angie's raising her finger behind me.
What happened?
Well, I don't remember all of the ins and outs.
Oh, come
anybody
on,
else
people.
Remembers. Chime in. But it was a question of a combination of things, of resources, of the schools having other things that they needed to be spending their time doing, of a private sector that already existed doing driver education,
yes,
saying, we can do this, you know, we can help with this. So it was kind of a perfect storm of things. The money was from the public safety education account, I believe.
Okay.
And so there were other things that it was going to be spent on. And again, there was more to it than that. But that was coupled with some other things, like the Traffic Safety Commission couldn't come to the table and say, we knew that driver education was creating a safer driver. The way that we deliver traffic safety education in this country, with many, many hours in the classroom and not very many hours behind the wheel, has not been shown to be a best practice. So we couldn't come to the table and said, oh, we're mad about this. We need to keep funding this, which was, you know, did not make us a favorite in those times.
Yes.
But it's just one of the complicating issues. at the end of this.
Exactly. And the bill, I mean, just to inform the discussion, I mean, this is all on the public record, was known as the wait time reduction bill.
Cool.
Well, that was later.
Later.
Yeah.
And so we're talking about two things. We have the defunding, right? Right, which, and everything you just said to set the stage.
And then in 2011
and
was
then in 20,
yeah.
Right. So it's been an evolution of a lot of different things that and I'm not putting a judgment on it. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I think one thing that would be really interesting is, so we have Target Zero that has all this amazing rich data about what will save lives and reduce serious injuries. But it will only if it's implemented correctly, right? The fact that we have this piece of paper that says it's going to happen doesn't make it happen.
Right.
So I think it would be fascinating to take this really pragmatic look of those of us as implementers and kind of look at Target Zero through a lens of implementation. Like, you know, what would require legislation, what wouldn't, what could we do by rule, what could we do by WAC, what's hard, you know, do some t-shirt sizing, what's hard, what's easy, what's going to require a multi-year discussion versus we think is a no-brainer. So I don't want to get too far outside of data, but I think we need to apply a pragmatic lens over it.
So I tend to be fairly lazy when I can, and when I come up with something that we're trying to do in within the scope of my position as a county commissioner, I'll often call other commissioners and say, have you guys approached this, have you done this, how does it work, what's worked, what's not worked, have we taken a look? I mean, so, you know, I guess we're talking about reinventing the wheel. Have we taken a look at other states and what their statistics are and what kind of regulations and programs they've put in place and to see what has worked and what isn't working? I've got to believe we have. Again, a rhetorical question.
Are you pointing at me? I'd love to answer that question.
Please do.
When you look at how we train drivers in this country, there's not much difference between states.
Yeah.
And as I think some states do it differently. Some states are starting to venture into what I would say a more intelligent way of delivering licenses, in that there's some tiered testing, which is a model that's used in many other countries. You know, 2 years ago, this state sent two people from the Department of Licensing to me, from the Traffic Safety Commission, two driver ed owner operators, and two citizens paid their own way to go look at the UK system. Because there are places that are doing this better. Not a wholly transferable system at all, but there are some sparks of things that are being done in Norway, in Australia, New Zealand, that may not be right for us, but there could be some elements there. But comparing with other states, the biggest thing that other states are doing that is making a difference in death and injury is that upgrade to the intermediate driver's license law, that law that 16-year-olds get that restricts their driving in the beginning. And that was part of this package, was to make some tweaks to that also. So we know that would take us somewhere as well, not just how we deliver driver education, but how we handle that license in those first years. And there are some states like New Jersey that are actually extending that intermediate driver's license phase, I guess there might be one other state, even beyond 18, so that that passenger restriction or that nighttime restriction would stay on for new drivers, no matter their young driver age. So does that answer your question?
Sure.
I have a tendency to get a little off track.
If I can jump in too, you know, for some of the things that we looked at, I have a matrix of all the other states that do all the things, whether it's requiring education over 18, whether they allow it online. You know, we looked at states that have subsidies. So we did, you know, as it continues to evolve, we're looking at other states, absolutely. And we looked at their models and some that do have, you know, lower fatality rates. Is, you know, I think you kind of decide what all you want to bite off in each chunk, right? I think that's the challenge, is sometimes things like the online education. I think a lot of the private driver training schools, I know that in our stakeholder, and that was a major concern for them. Very disruptive business model, has a potential to lower the cost a lot when we look at other states that offer it. But also things like expanding the requirement, you know, that also, there's sort of the they kind of have to weigh, if you kind of go comprehensively, there's those benefits where it's expanding the amount of people that would be taking services and, you know, the subsidy, sort of looking at that, not just for that 18 to 25, but also for 16 and 17, you know, those now that, you know, are required to take it, and a lot of them are waiting. I think, you know, what we see is that 70% of low-income people wait till they're 18, and only 20% of sort of, you know, high-income people do. That's clearly, that's a huge delta in terms of the effects of that. And we see that, you know, people that are 18 to 19, you know, I think a lot of you, for the PowerPoint we had the last time we met, right, where I showed you, if you're an 18 to 19-year-old, you're twice as likely to die in a fatality if you didn't take driver's ed versus those that took it, they're 18 to 19. Twice as likely to die. You know, highest rate of fatalities among all the age groups. So, I mean, we know there's, you know, there at least appears by the data to be some benefit, but, you know, as Teresa pointed out, it's extremely expensive and time-consuming for folks. And, you know, that's, like it or not, the license is the key to the livelihood for a lot of people. So we had to, you know, we had to be careful in weighing those impacts, as well as, you know, our partners that provide services for us and how it impacted them and their concerns. So it's continuing to evolve, and we're going to keep working on it.
Well, I appreciate that you've come to the decision to pull back a little bit, because I mean, you're not going to get a lot of bites at the apple when it comes to the legislature, so get it right. I mean, I think that's the important thing. Do the research, make a decision that's you feel is going to be effective long term, and then go forward to the legislature, because you don't want to go in there and ask for something and, you know, 5 years later come back and say, well, what we really needed was this, because that in my experience with the legislature, that really kicks them off. So.
Any other thoughts? I really do want to be bold on Target Zero, and I have an appetite for that. And I think, you know, some would argue that the legislative environment is a place to have the debate. I think it absolutely is. And I think we need to do our complete staff work. I think it's not mutually exclusive, right?
Sure.
Yeah. I think the whole overall thing of that, the fatalities are going up, and we've had this set of things that worked for a while. They don't seem to be working anymore. And it's one, I think, of breadth of issues. But it does impact, I think, both really rural areas, because I think about South Bend and Raymond. They don't have a driving school out there. So what are those kids doing? Where, you know, Carl used to teach it. He was the high school teacher, taught everybody to drive in South Bend, Raymond, Willoughby. He's not there anymore. You know, so it is a huge thing. I had another kid that went through it twice, flunked it twice, and she doesn't drive. That's a good thing. Believe it.
Right,
that's a good thing.
Right.
I had another, my last one, she passed it. But the instructor was an old-time driving instructor, had been high school driving instructor, worked for the school in Longview. And he says, she's passed it. She's technically passed it, but you need to keep her in the car a lot longer and do things. So much of it is up to the parents and your ability to understand. I have so many friends that they didn't understand anything about the graduated license or whatever, because their kids hadn't told them and they hadn't kept up. And they were telling me, I said, they can't be out at night, and they can't be out with a carload of kids. Then what do you mean? I said, things have changed. But they didn't understand it, because so much is on the parents, and they're not keeping up with it like they did when it was at school. Mm-hmm. So anyway, The Last Prom, I still remember that movie from Driver's Ed. Mm-hmm. But they see so many more gory things now just on their YouTube phone. The Last Prom was like a picnic. I mean, so anyway, things have changed, but it does take a lot of time, and it is expensive, and so it's a mess.
So,
anyway.
So when you're thinking of potentially some subsidies that could assist maybe the lower income students that were going into driver's ed, I mean, have you had some thoughts on that, or some ideas? I mean, is there some things that we could discuss here?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I think the kind of where we sort of ended up was the idea of it would basically qualify, I think, for those that were on any sort of type of public benefits, so like, you know, SNAP, Medicaid, Medicare, or like I think it was maybe 150% of the federal poverty level, and it would cover about half the cost of driver training, and then it would be funded with a sort of fee on renewal and original driver's license transactions of about like $2 to $3. So that's what we'll pay. It's obviously new fees. That's controversial, right? And it's certainly, depending on how much you wanted to provide and how strict you wanted the pool to be, right? If you wanted to make it broader or less broad, you could raise or lower any of those amounts. But we'll provide about like $250, you know, per student. And we thought that would capture that pool, basically, of those that were sort of met those low-income criteria, which were based on, for the ignition interlock device, sort of the low-income criteria for that. So use the same statutory definition. This is a starting point, you know, for the low-income for the driver training.
So maybe you're going to go down this road as well. I think you guys are applying for a pretty hefty grant or something through Medicare or Medicaid. Would any of that help cover some of those costs?
So I would have to check on that.
Okay.
And that's not where I was going, so if we want to have a conversation about that.
Go ahead with what you're going to say.
So I'm just curious if the data shows that a fee on service for driver education is going to reduce that gap. I think about driving in total, low income, buying a car, insurance, fuel, all of those other things don't go away. And I'm curious if other states that have gone down this road of asking for fees, increasing subsidies and things like that, have demonstrated any increase at all in the number of underserved populations. As we're having these conversations about health disparities, it's much more complex than the dollars and cents to pay for the courses. And so I would just encourage us to look at that and see if that's the thing that's happening. If it is, maybe that's the route we want to go. If not, that could be a really controversial, long, drawn-out thing that in the end doesn't get us over.
I agree, and I asked, not quite intelligently as you just asked them, but I asked some similar questions, and I and correct me, anyone in this room, please, I'd love to be wrong, but I don't feel like we do have that data. And you know, that we there's always this struggle between the art of perfection and, right, but I think we need to at least gather what we know and then talk to people who do what you do and that can help us ask the right questions. At least we need to be aware of what we don't know.
Well, it's interesting.
I don't feel like we're there.
When you look at some that will say, yeah, I fall into that category, but they own an iPhone 10 and, you know, they have some other luxuries. You know, I think that begs the question, if you're meeting in that, are you going to be able to drive anyway? Do you have the ability to pay for insurance? Do you, you know, I think that's a very interesting counterpoint to see how does that all work out. I mean, there's people that are going to fall within that category. So but I think it's a great discussion to at least go and say, look, we've explored all these different things, have the data.
And I would add, we did definitely have some conversation with DSHS as well about sort of that approach. And one thing that I find interesting about the discussion too is they reminded me that having a driver's license, even if you can't afford to have a car, that actually opens up a lot of job opportunities for you, even if you, just because that's sometimes a requirement for basic type of things, you know, your license to drive. And so, because that was one of my things, was like driving is expensive. You know, if you're, even if you provide the subsidy, is it going to move the needle? Is this a group that can even, you know, afford to drive? You know, what are they doing now? But that was a good point, was it's like, well, look, if they don't even have that opportunity, they can't even drive the truck or something, you know, or just a car that maybe their employer would provide so they can work. So that is one piece we, you know, we continue to work with kind of like the Economic Services Administration, DSHS, around their goals for those populations. And one of them is transportation related, you know, how do we help these people be able to sort of get to that job or, you know, drop the kid off child care. And they see licensure as a really big part of that. So that would be a good, I think, opportunity to continue getting their feedback on what's the right level of qualifying for the subsidy. I mean, I think it would be great if it could just be funded, right, out of somewhere out of the transportation pot. My experience has been that they always like at least that option, right, of make it self-funding somehow, or you throw that out there.
Right.
Do we have the Commissioner of Insurance, that group on the board, too? Because I'm friends with an attorney, and she deals with a lot of people that never got their license, they drive, never been insured. Some of them drive their whole lives, never get caught, everything's fine. They get caught, of course, the book gets thrown at them, and then they got to kind of start over. I think there's a lot of folks that drive that are not insured.
Yes, there are, right?
Ton of people, and that's a huge issue, too.
Absolutely. So what I'd like to do is have my people with your people, queue up the discussion, and then bring in the larger group and try to be systematic about it. Is that all right, everyone?
If we engage the, you know, the people we're talking about to see what they think and might be something we do as part of the process.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, I think George, isn't he a district court judge?
Yes, in Shelton.
In Shelton. He would be, I think, a great resource on this because they deal with this all day long. You know,
but I mean, I literally mean like drivers, you know, 18 to 25 and folks in low income. And,
exactly. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay, so Bo, can you talk to us about motorcycle conversation?
Sure. I think there's a handout.
In your packet.
So, sort of part of the, part of the focus for the agency, when we look at motorcycle fatalities, we essentially see no reduction going all the way back to 2005.
When did the boomers start retiring? Because they're the ones that jump on the motorcycle. With no experience.
And so, you see motorcycles disproportionately represented in seriously fatalities. And 75% of the time in motorcycle fatalities, the motorcyclist was determined at fault. I think that is a significant point as well. So this bill is kind of built out of a couple of things. One is a NHTSA assessment, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. They had two recommendations for the motorcycle safety program within DOL. One of those was to eliminate the maximum hours of instruction for motorcycle training and the maximum fee. So give more flexibility for schools to provide longer trainings and let sort of that be adjusted to reflect the sort of options that are available to do more comprehensively. So that's part of the bill. Another one of them is making the test more meaningful. So right now, to get a motorcycle endorsement, you pass your knowledge exam, and you do a short test around a parking lot, 12, 15 miles an hour. And after that, basically, you've got this endorsement to ride without restriction any motorcycle on the public roadways, on the highway. If you're someone who's got virtually no experience, you can do one of these trainings, get through the training, take all your tests, and then within 2 days, having never ridden on a motorcycle, you're kind of free and clear to just go out there. And we see that, new motorcyclists, it's like, in fatality, it's like 95% of the time, they're at fault. And when we look at these, and so it sort of goes down over time. So the idea is just basic skills test to get your permit, right? And then a more advanced test to get your endorsement with giving more time to practice in there. And so this would just allow more like experiential learning. Motorcycles are a little bit different, and it's more tricky to have an instructor present on board a motorcycle than it is for a car, right? Where are you going to put them on the back? There's some of those unique challenges to motorcycles. And so the idea of the two test model is to get that basic test that sort of allows them, okay, you're clear to at least be able to go practice driving a motorcycle around the public roadways now. And, you've got the time frame for that. And then you get your endorsement, be a higher speed test, more complex maneuvers. Second piece, this is the NHTSA recommendation about revising our motorcycle safety advisory board. We're going to put WASPIC on there, traffic safety, just add a couple more members. We've had trouble getting quorums, getting recommendations to DOL, so we think that will help advance that cause, get some of those good ideas generated, bring stuff forward for the agency. Fourth piece, increasing the penalty for riding unendorsed. So right now, your base penalty for riding unendorsed is like, I think it's $47, and it's about $136 when you add all of the fees. We're increasing that up to $300 for the base penalty. And so the idea is being much more of a deterrent for riding unendorsed than there is now.
Did you say $46?
$47 is the base penalty, right, under the current law. So those are kind of the four pieces of the bill. And, we've been working with traffic. We got the support of traffic safety, the patrol on the bill, so thank you guys for that. WASPIC is neutral on it. I know there's some that have been really engaged in this, and we appreciate all that support. AAA is on board, so that's great. A number of the schools have weighed in support. Abate did weigh in with opposition as well as Washington Road Riders, so you know, if the governor and all of them decide to move the bill forward, we will have to contend with that as part of the legislative process. But we've been working with them and, of course, listening to their concerns. And so,
what's their biggest opposition?
I think the big ones are the additional tests. There's some confusion about the motorcycle subsidy, which is not part of the bill. And that sort of, with both the schools and some of the rider organizations, they're concerned that's going away. We were able to subsequently clear that up, but that was one of the things that came out of the initial feedback. But also just, I mean, and to be honest, some of the feedback wasn't even really that germane to the bill, but it was just, I don't think they sort of the overall feel of it. They didn't.
Freedom.
You just feel picked up.
Yeah, but it was making it harder to become a motorcyclist. It was just raising those barriers to be able to ride a motorcycle. That was, you know, a lot of it was just that overall vibe that I got. Is that you're making it harder for people to legally ride a motorcycle. You're raising barriers.
Well, I appreciate you moving forward on this because, as you've seen, the average of 73 motorcyclists every year is just not acceptable. And I know we've done a lot of things over the past, looking at endorsements and changing processes and that. And now, I mean, even from our perspective, when we receive federal funds for motorcycles, really the federal funds that come in, because the advocates have pushed Congress in such a way that we only can use it for education. So it's very limited for us to be able to do it for enforcement. And so, you know, they're taking away now the ability to do motorcycle helmet surveys. So you can go out and see how many people are actually wearing helmets that are legal to be on the road. And so we've never really done that, but other states have. And so this is one way to help, I guess, address this issue and this problem. Because, as you've said, 75% of these are the motorcycles at fault. Yet, what's the message that we hear and the education that we put out has to be, it's the big bad passenger vehicle that's killing all the motorcycles. And that's the wrong perception. And it was just like we did with the commercial vehicles. It's the big bad commercial vehicles killing all these people. No, same thing. 75% of those fatal crashes involving a CMV, it was the passenger vehicle that was at fault. So a lot of these are single bike, going too fast, impaired, and that's where we see a lot of the problems with motorcycles. So they've actually kind of handcuffed us on many of the abilities to do enforcement. So Mark Medallen back here is our program manager over the impaired driving and motorcycles, and I know that he's really been working with your group, and I appreciate that, and appreciate Mark doing this, because this is, we want them to be, you know, is able to operate on our roadways just like any other vehicle. But we want to help prepare some of those steps so that they are not getting killed. So, yeah, so thank you and your team for moving this forward.
Great. Thank you. Great. Any questions on that?
Just one comment. We're already hearing rumblings about a bill that would remove our mandatory helmet law. This time, it looks like it would be a pilot project for 2 years to not require motorcycle helmets for people who are 21 and older. Of course, that makes enforcement, you know, how do you know? The person's supposed to have a motorcycle helmet or not if you don't know their ages. And it's not like we haven't seen bills trying to do this every single year, but I do think that as a commission, all of us have a stake in making sure we're killing fewer people, as few as we can. We know we've done this before in this state many times, well, twice. Twice we've removed the helmet law, and we've watched deaths of motorcyclists increase. So we don't really need a pilot to know what the results are. Other states have removed the motorcycle helmet law, and they've watched motorcycle deaths increase. So if we get to that legislative session and, you know, the hearing is packed with people that are all for
yes.
removing. I just think it would be great for us to have a good, strong commission presence saying no.
One thing I'm hearing from legislators really quickly is they're being handed doing studies about helmets in their minds. So I think that is a role, personally, that the commission could play, is to help clarify, perhaps?
We do have a white paper on our website.
Wonderful.
About motorcycle helmets and what the research really says about them.
Okay, perfect.
Now, one other thing, too, is when we talk about motorcyclists, is that they have optional insurance. It's not mandatory that a motorcyclist has insurance. And so when they are in a crash, and they don't have insurance, who's going to pick up the tab?
Well, and this the bill that's being talked about would require them to, would only allow the helmet to be optional if they had insurance, but again...
So that's until you're there, and when you're there, it's too late.
Yeah.
Right. And that's then
the power burden
that comes on the state at times to pick up the costs.
Right.
So would it make sense for a cross-agency high-level folks asking to meet with the potential bill sponsor?
If you're looking at me, my answer would be yes.
Sure. Yeah.
Do we know who the sponsor's going to be this year?
Yeah. Yes.
We all need that person's support.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think you raise a really good point, and as a recovering legislative staff, you know, I think I think this is something that we could I wish we would ask ourselves a little more often and talk about that, because
I mean, yeah. Is there a way to head it off at the pass and not even get there is really what we need to do. It
yeah.
Really as a priority coming into a budget year, is this really something you want to spend all your time on? And I think we could make an argument that no, you don't.
It's a delicate situation. But,
My guess is as soon as you got someone to drop the ball, you'd find somebody else more than willing to pick it up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, driving around the East Coast, I think if you don't have the requirement helmet, you have to have the bandana or the American flag up around your face like this so you look like going down the road to rob a bank. Or the do-rag on top. I mean, the do-rag must be fabulous.
Something like that, and realizing yes. that as staff, our job is also to help work with the bill sponsor and what they're trying to achieve.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It is delicate, and acknowledging that, and what can we be very strategic about, you know, being factual and to your point, getting at the core value. Yes.
Yeah.
And the data is so strong that, you know, if we're just presenting what we know about the data.
And I think thinking about this beyond the data in terms of values and how we
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. So
this is part of our traffic safety culture.
Yes.
And it's that values, the attitudes around it, the beliefs, the intention, the willingness, because this is something I think we've seen, even though we're seeing a lot of people die in motorcycle crashes, very few of them. If, I think we had one or two that just didn't have a helmet on. Mm-hmm. So the rest of them are high impact crashes.
Those are going pretty fast.
Off the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were looking at freedom from death and disability.
Yes.
Right. Well stated.
That's a real rally.
It is. That's pretty darn good.
Yeah. Yes. Freedom from death and disability.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay. Wonderful. Shelly.
Bud.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to look at this little colorful circle that I put together just to give you a real quick look at our agency request legislation this year, which is to create an active transportation safety advisory council. So as you can see, this would be comprised of two existing councils. One is the pedestrian safety advisory council, which the legislators established in 2015. It has an expiration date of 2019. So we've had about 4 years. They produced process of producing their fourth report. And the Bicycle Safety Advisory Council was established 2 years later in 2017. It also expires in 2019. So by combining councils, we continue the work that they've been doing, and we make it cheaper. So right now it's about $200,000 a biennium. This would bring it down to $150,000 a biennium. We're expanding a little bit of their role, so we're adding that the council will monitor the recommendations that they've made. So they've made 3 years' worth of recommendations on the PED side, a year of recommendations on the bike side, and then being able to go in and actually see how and what's happening with the recommendations that they're making. Some of them can be done just by agencies, and others would require legislative pieces, so it's just an ability to continue to track that. As well as eliminating some duplication of effort and increasing the coordination so that they can take on that role of support for all non-motorists and not just bicycles and pets. For fun, behind this, there's just a brief description of the bill, and after that, there's actually the bill. So if anybody has any questions about it, I can certainly go more in depth.
Do we have a sponsor, or are we recruiting a sponsor?
Oh, thank you very much for that. So this is agency request. So at this point, it's sitting at OFM in the governor's office.
Okay.
And we'll find out sometime in December if they're going to allow us to move it forward.
Shelly, may I just add, same with us on the motorcycle, just caveat, there's a process we need to go through.
Right.
We all know that process.
Yes, yes.
At the point where they tell us it's okay to do, then we look for sponsors.
Yes.
Okay, we can't do that before that.
Okay.
Sorry, John, I'm going to cut
you. But if you have suggestions, I'm certainly willing to hear them.
Are the advisory councils on board with the request? Like, do they support?
This comes from the advisory councils. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. In fact, they were required to make a fiscal request of the legislature August 1. So they already made the fiscal request for the money to the legislature. But then in talking about the best approach, the governor's office really wanted us to put it in as agency request instead of just leaving it to them. So, and it could be that we end up not moving forward with the bill because another legislator wants to take it up. And there's probably one in each chamber that would do that. So,
and they have this information. They're privy to the advisory committees combining.
So I don't get to talk to them about it until the governor's office tells me I can.
Right. I mean,
at that point, we'll share with them very freely.
Right.
However, they are aware that this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Actually, they've been coming to the meetings.
Well, that's good. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
They're pretty aware.
Cool.
So Scott Waller back here is one of our program managers, and he is actually the one that coordinates and facilitates the both pedestrian and bicycle advisory councils, and they meet monthly. Mm-hmm. And it is, I mean, very full. When you walk out of there, you feel like your brain is just, because there's so much. And I think it's important as we look at pedestrians in this state have significantly gone up over the years,
right,
and have been higher, especially with bicycles. So that's kind of the why behind all this. So, yeah. So great job. Thank you, Jill.
And you're on for the next one, too.
Oh.
Senate Law and Justice Committee work session?
Oh, yeah. So, real quick. On the 24th, the Senate Law and Justice Committee is having a work session around impaired driving. They've invited us to come and speak during the work session. So our research director, Dr. Hoff, and Erica Escada, are going to be presenting to the committee. We're going to be talking about just the state of the state, increasing traffic crashes, increasing impaired driving crashes. Quarter of all of our fatals are now related to a driver that's impaired by more than one substance. Dr. Hoff had written a paper, which we published in April of this year, talking about that poly drug use and what it really looks like. And then we've just finished up about a year and a half project doing surveys to understand the culture of poly drug users, so people who use alcohol and marijuana and drive. So we'll be presenting those findings as well. Real quick, the big overall finding is about 9% of the population uses alcohol and marijuana and drives within 2 hours. So 91% of us don't do that. We have a very strong culture that says it's wrong. Most people believe it's dangerous and unacceptable. But within that 9%, we're seeing a couple of things that are kind of disturbing about their knowledge. And one of those things is that they are more likely to believe, to say that they would use marijuana after drinking to help them feel more sober and ready to drive. So we see a huge disconnect in knowledge. And I think that there may, this is just my own personal opinion. There may be some change of state. So if you have been using alcohol, you feel drunk, and you use another substance, marijuana in this case, you're going to feel different. But that feeling different isn't ready to drive. Mm. And, you know, it doesn't take away the deficits of alcohol. It just adds to it. So that's, we're excited to start bringing a lot of these messages about culture into our education and into our campaigns. And we'll be out on a mad dash to actually present the survey to as many people as we possibly can, just to get that conversation going. I think sometimes people around the people that might be doing it don't know. You know, if they're saying, no, I'm going to smoke a joint, I'll be fine to drive, leave me alone. And you're going, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, it seems silly, but if you don't know, you don't know.
Right.
So
the 9% is creating what percentage of our fatalities?
Well, impairment overall is 50% of our fatalities. Okay. Polydrug use is a quarter of our fatalities. Okay. Polydrug use is any type of combination, alcohol and a drug, a couple of drugs. But the most common combination for polydrug use is alcohol and marijuana. So we're excited to present the findings, and hopefully we'll have a chance to present the survey to you guys in the future, too.
Thank you. Daniela.
Yeah. This was a fascinating conversation to listen to, and I kept making notes on my presentation, and I wish I couldn't change it while I was sitting there. Everything you guys talked about, I will speak to today in some form or context, and Director Grandel met with me and other folks from DOT to talk about, you know, how do we prepare for this presentation, how do we make it relevant, how does it connect to what you're doing, and I wish I had been here last month and last quarter and listened to what you just talked about. I'm going to come back with more specifics, but I'm really excited that all the things that, and I realize now what you talked about, what you talked about is really related to automated and connected vehicles and automation that we are facing right now. So that's my spiel today. I know quite a few of you in a different role at WatchDOT. I was spending 15 years in systems analysis and all things performance management and strategic planning and systems analysis, congestion analysis, and I had a family emergency about almost 10 months ago, which made me realize I need to change a little bit how I look at work. And I was brought into this opportunity saying, you know, there's another thing we could do, Daniela, if you want to step out of this crazy job you have now and do something that requires you less time at the office, more time as your family member. And I accepted this challenge. So here I am, and it's not easy. And it's definitely not slow. So would you mind helping me with moving around, because I have some notes, and I do want to speak to my notes a little bit. So we talked about cooperative transportation and automation, and you know there's CV, AV, CAV, all these different acronyms are kicked around, autonomous, automated, connected, and the transportation industry is trying to come to terms with what it means. And you know, we're still creating acronyms, and
that's our number one job.
Yeah, I mean, good at this, right?
Yeah, very good.
And this is on a national basis, international basis, so I have the benefit of communicating with some of my colleagues in Europe, and they're struggling with the same issue. What seems to be coming to sort of terms is this term, cooperative automated transportation, and it's intentionally being used to talk about just more than cars or automation of vehicles, because it's much broader. This technology revolution that we're in the middle of is much broader than just cars. It affects every mode of transportation. So it looks at how the modes work together. It's not just this one car driving down the transportation system and does its own thing. It's really a connected system looking at all pieces. Automated because it has automation of all elements of transportation. Bicycling, scooters, you know, shuttles, all of this. It's not just the personal or trucks that you maybe know about. So again, looking at all sort of transportation modes that are automated can affect all aspects of the transportation industry. And again, that's the automation. And autonomous too. And you talk about autonomous, and it's still used quite a bit, but you can see it moving to automate a little bit in some of the terminology. It talks about, it's implied that you're working independently. You have a blindfold on, you go into the transportation system, which particularly this commission is very worried about, obviously, you know, because safety issues. So it's interdependent, it's not independent. So, you know, the word itself, autonomous, implies an independency that's not there. And then transportation, because it's the entire system, all the systems, local, city, county, all the systems that we own, not just owned by the public, but also by the private providers, which are a huge player in this field. So I'll put you on the next slide. WashJet's working on a transportation, on a CAP policy framework. And we have several, we have 8 policy goals, and I want to talk about safety today. Organizing for innovation, shared mobility, economic vitality, infrastructure, and context-sensitive street design, land use, equity, and environment are the other policy goals we have. And I want to say that the legislative 6 policy goals in statute relate closely to these, so we try to align those. We also align with the SALTS Washington, the governor's strategic plan, and the SALTS Washington's strategic plan. So we're not creating more layers of policy frameworks. We're trying to align them all together in this CAP policy framework. And if you would like, go to the next slide. So this is a draft. This is not by any means, this is WashJet's internal draft. This is what we call our policy goal right now. But advanced driving systems and highly automated vehicles will be deployed in a manner that increases the safety and security of the transportation system and all of its users. All of its users. So again, that's the way to look at this a little differently from maybe what you have sort of seen before and talked before. And I want to kind of, at this point, I had such a hard time not jumping in your conversation earlier today. I was just like sitting there, just don't raise your hand again, because you really give a presentation and just hear us guess. But I'm German, I can pick that up. But you know how much it cost me a long time ago? I don't want to give my age away to get a license in Europe. Mm-hmm. It was 1,000 marks, which was equivalent to $1,000. That was like a long time ago. Yeah. Now, my friend's teenager kids spending 3,000 euros, not dollars, to get that license. It's a very expensive proposition in Europe. And I can tell you, some of my friends have sent their kids to the States to study abroad for 6 months, go to high school, spend 6 months having fun, because they don't really do much when they come there, you know, it's just more having fun. But they always get their license, because it's only a couple $100 for them. And then back to Germany, and they get credit for it, and they don't have to take the test, they don't have to do the hours, if they can show they've been here and driven a certain amount of hours. Yeah. And it saves them about 2,500 euros. So if you think you have a bad deal, it's all perspective. And I cannot tell you how many of my friends' children who have the ability and can afford to send their kids to the States for different, not necessarily Washington State, I'm not saying that's here, but they have gone to other states in this country, and get their license. By the time they get back home, they have their license. And they're avoiding a huge investment in time and resources. So at this point, the German government is still acknowledging
So Danielle is willing to testify.
It's easier, it's quicker, it's cheaper, and all of that. So I just don't want to, you know, it's all a perspective. But I do realize the equity issues, and equity is one important element in our policy framework. The other thing I want to just listen to your conversation about the fatality issues and the increasing, you know, one of the things we're trying to do with automation is also reduce congestion. Reduce fatalities and injuries, because as you've seen, Catherine showed this great slide, and I should have put it in my presentation, is the recession, the post-recession increase in fatality rates and injury rates are going up again, because congestion and safety kind of is closely connected. So if we can hit one of those items, we often can impact the other. And I think all we agree, we don't want another recession just to reduce safety numbers, right? So that's not the way to go about it. So hopefully you have a better way. By the way, just another story here. No, I don't have much time, but I want to tell you a story. I hired Catherine to watch that when she came out of grad school, so I feel really responsible for one of the things she says.
Good job.
And I wanted to congratulate her on all the stuff she's been done since she left WashJet. In the same turn, Rosemary Sepola here, I interviewed her about 20 years ago when I applied for a job at WashJet as a Washington State Transportation Plan Manager to create a new transportation plan for Washington State. And I was fairly young in my career and fairly unexperienced, and I knew I had some heavy, needed some heavy guns to come into this job. And so I said, who can I talk to? Who's going to tell me the truth about this job and what I need to do to make it better? Because it was about improving the planning process and bringing more stakeholders
into
the process.
God knows it needed.
And she spent an hour with me on the phone, and she gave me everything I need to know. She didn't hold back, and I got the job. So anyway, I just want to say,
and look where you are, Danielle.
If anything else wrong today, it's from your fault.
Yeah.
I know you deal with impairment, driving, distracted driving, seatbelt, child restraints. I think these are all issues that we relate with the automation issue. So if you can go to the next slide. One more. This is something that Debbie, who presented to you from the commission here, staff presented to you, I think, in July. I just want to talk about connected vehicles may not be autonomous. Autonomous vehicle may not be connected. The ideal situation is to be both connected. We talk to each other, the infrastructure system, each other, and we also provide some level of automation, provide some services currently to reduce these injuries, safety, and safety statistics that we're also concerned about. So, next slide. You have seen this. You all are probably driving a semi-automatic vehicle right now. I mean, what I should say is the future started yesterday, because we all sit here and wondering when this automation is coming. All of you drive a new car off the lot parking lot at your dealership. You're going to have semi-automation. You have level 2 for sure, level 1 for sure. I drive a 15-year-old car, and I have level 1 in my car already. I bought it 15 years ago. I was surprised when I learned that my little European car has auto sensors for when it rains. I mean, sure, was coming on, which is great in Washington State, right? So this thing happens and it works perfectly. That was already 15 years ago. It's a really old car, but it already has that sense of safety for me, because I don't have to worry about finding my windshield wipers. It turns it on and it adjusts the speed. That's a really old car. And I'm just thinking all of your cars have this different level of automation. You're already in that zone. You're already engaged in that reality. So I just want to kind of say that as part of that conversation. The other conversation I thought was really interesting you have is when we talk about licensing and getting our licenses and so forth, you have really a powerful tool and also a dangerous tool, potentially driving a new car off the lot without any training on these features. You know, we're dealing with a lot of features that are really helpful to reduce crashes and increase safety, but they could also do the opposite if it's not used properly. So adaptive cruise control, for example, you know, assist driving assist, braking assist, parking assist, all these are things. And how is the person that's getting a license 5 years from now, what do they need to do in order to get a license? They need to drive a car that has all these features and need to get a license, not so much of cars that we maybe built 20 years ago. And how is that influencing your conversation, but you're going to require of young drivers, right? Mm-hmm. And it's all a very integrated conversation we have today. Next slide.
So quick question, if I might. So knowing that, and I mean, not exactly sure the horizon, but like what do we need to be preparing for, and like what are there legislative things we ought to be getting through now that prepare us for that?
I will talk to you about it in a little bit. We get closer to the next slide, if you don't mind. I'm going to skip this one, but this is sort of it's a funny way of looking at what happens when things expedite. In 1900s, there's all, you know, carriages, horses, and just 13 years later, there's only one post on carriage in this whole picture, and you can see the, you know, how fast things can change. So just a reality check for all of us. Next slide. And again, there's at least 10 makers, car makers, automakers, who say that they will be at level 4 within the next 3 years. Mm. And so that's really a reality that they're already in. And some are faster, more ahead than others, but they're all projecting that's where they're going to be on the market. Again, the reality is right now. We are just in this mode at this point. Next slide. So how did WashDOT, how did we organize? I mean, I know this is a little bit how your organization, all the folks on the table, the commissioners on the table, the folks who are staffing this commission, all the people who are dealing with these safety issues, how do you prepare? I mean, WashDOT is not any different from some of your organizations. We don't have a crystal ball that says, when do we need staff up to do what? Because everybody sort of hedges their bets and waits to see what's happening. And it's kind of a duplicate process. you're going to continue to do your current activities to operations. You know, you bus your kids to school on traditional buses. At the same time, you're going to explore other ways of getting kids to the school system, right? You're providing training right now. You're going to continue doing that, driver's training in the current vein. It's a current reality, but at the same time, you need to kind of have a duplicate process that says, okay, so what happens if they're going to have these type of cars? What happens if they're going to have, you know, so many tools that allows them not to have to think too much anymore? You know, maybe that kind of testing will be different. Maybe we'll test on different skill sets, different capabilities. So again, we did the same thing. We created sort of a work group from each agency's division to say, let's work together to figure out how to prepare. I was asked to join this effort, like I said, and it's kind of like this. When I started there, one of the things, this is really slow moving. That was like in April when I came back from family leave. And they said, it's going to be slow moving. You're going to have lots of time to work with your family. In the cycle, in the last 4 months, since I'm job stops like this, it's like crazy. We have probably 50 speaking engagements in like 3 weeks. We have been asked to talk to so many different organizations who want to know how they can prepare and what to do. And we're just one of you. I mean, we're one of you trying to figure out how to staff for that. So Ted and I are basically working together to figure out how to get some of these, what's falling out of the cycle. And there's a lot of things that are falling out that we think we can focus on right now to maybe bring those forward and work on those. Because we don't have control over this, right? The industry is moving this forward faster than we possibly can in state government. But at the same time, industry is really interested in working with us, and some of these things fall out. They fall out, and we can say, oh, you know, we can try with this tractor tuning. We can maybe work on this. There's a couple things we can work on. So so that's how we approach it at WASHTA. So we're working with many different stakeholders outside of the agency, and Director Brundell is the chair of the AD Executive Committee for Washington State, and I'm sure you will hear more about this as we move forward. We make some really great strides in a very short time and doing some really good things in that organization. Next slide. And so this is what WASHTA is currently after, but all of you are working on many of those subcommittees right now. So again, it's a really good process moving very quickly.
So Daniela, just to quickly, in reference to your question, Commissioner, is under licensing, they have a whole subcommittee looking and evaluating this. Mm-hmm. And then next Wednesday, the 24th, we meet again, and then that we're going to have a report out from all those subcommittees. And looking at, some of them won't have any recommendations, because we feel like it's a little bit premature at this point, and we've only been really operating since the passage. And so next year, we may have some additional things. But this overall, these five different subcommittees are really looking at those areas specific to see what we can do. And really, for safety, one of the biggest things that they're looking at is really getting good, clear information out to the public. Because there's just so much coming, nobody really knows. And then there's that, is it safe? Is it reliable? You know, can I trust this? So I think when people look at what, as far as autonomous vehicles, there's a lot of reluctance from the public. And helping to, I think, getting back to being positive on it.
Yeah. So. Next slide. And you can skip that comment. Okay, next one. So some of these nuggets are falling out right now. Some early wins or early opportunities to move forward. Again, we cannot sit here and wait until we all have the perfect answer and the crystal ball tells us what to do, because it's not going to happen. None of us will know exactly how the technology, the industry, at what speed. Is it going to be 5 years? Is it 2 years? Is it 10 years? We don't know. But we know some things are falling out early. Things are clear. So driver-assisted truck platooning, we're not talking about 10, 15 trucks in a row. We're talking about pairs of two trucks where the front driver is the assist driver and the back is a driver that's in the truck, but that driver gives up control to the front truck, to the commercial vehicle. So there's so many, this is happening right now, and I think you're going to a presentation with which organization is doing it? Daimler's
doing it in Oregon.
We have Peloton coming to state. Peloton is talking to the governor's office right now. Likely this will happen in Washington State sooner or later. This is one of those early things we're going to attempt to do. And again, it's about safety on the transportation system. This will increase commercial vehicle safety for us, those of us who are, you know, who are engaging in this activity, that's their business, and those of folks who are affected by it. So again, this is very important.
Danielle, I had a quick question for you. So you said there's an active driver in the first vehicle and a passive driver in the second vehicle. How does that improve safety?
Well, because the there have a the crash, so the reaction of the driver that's in the second vehicle. So if they come upon a situation where the driver in the front truck has to brake, the system is automatically taking over and helping the truck in the second vehicle to do that, to engage the braking system. So that driver is there to mind and disconnect if they need to, but that driver receives information from the front driver. So if you ever seen these videos where you see 50 commercial trucks hitting each other because the conditions on the road were icy or something, this will provide advanced information, not just to the second driver, but also to the first driver. So it's a very integrated system, again, to look into both the connected vehicle to the outside infrastructure, but also from vehicle to vehicle. So again.
And one thing too with that too is when we saw the presentation, it's about safety, but it was also about fuel efficiency, because the truck could come in and draft off of the first one, and it was at a distance where it could stop if it needed to make an emergency stop. And so I think that was another element that I think is attractive.
The other thing I think is important to tell the public is we're not talking about like platooning of 15 trucks in a row. We're talking about a pair of two. So again, that's sort of where we need to be now and being more realistic. This is a safety, this is a worker safety issue for us. We're getting hit 40 times a year on these attenuators. This would be a driverless attenuator truck that can be hit, and there would be nobody in there that would be subject to injury. So again, that's something we're looking at right now to do. Governor's office is really interested in this. It looks like it might be happening. Either we're going to have to purchase new trucks or some retrofitting of trucks, but it's definitely a safety issue that we hope to mitigate some of those safety impacts on these road tree operations. Again, we are providing information to the clouds that potentially can be picked up by the industry, by different providers, to translate that information and give it to you in your personal cars and to the trucking, for example, to say, this is the situation, this is what's happening on this roadway, either on the condition of the roadway or what we're doing to clear the pass. So this is a very realistic, likely scenario that could happen fairly soon. So next one. Talking about, you heard about signing and striping a lot. We have the opportunity to maybe enhance our signing and striping with the eye towards the future, to this new reality of transportation and what that means and how we can enhance that. That doesn't mean we go out and stripe and sign everything new. It just means when we go out there and do something, perhaps we can make it in a way that is ready for the industry. But the industry, just to be clear, has said, we don't need you to do anything. Just don't put any barriers in the way for us, right? But yet, if the automation goes further, we want to be ready for that. And run of the roads are one of the major fatality reasons and injury reasons in rural areas, as you know better than I do from your statistics. I mean, it's a significant issue, and that could significantly decrease the run of the roads. So again, a real opportunity for us there to work on this. Next one. Again, this is about the traffic information on an intersection giving to either DSSC or through, talking about cell phone technology, but there's different opportunities for this to happen, and then that information will be transferred to the car so they know, red light ahead or some kind of situation that comes out of this intersection, and that information can be given to the driver. So again, that's a really, so we're looking at several locations in Washington State where we're trying to implement this right now on intersections in Washington State, and it's a pilot. We're trying to see how it's working, how we use that information. It's already happening right now. So again, that's reality. It's not something that happens 5 years from now. That happens all across the country. There is a SPAT challenge. They're calling it a SPAT challenge, single phase and timing challenge, which maybe was challenging all DOTs across the country to do some of this. And so many have participated in this, and many are installing these devices right now so they can communicate out from that intersection. Next one. Again, something near and dear to your discussion today. This is happening right now. PS Transit is taking a pilot project where they're automating certain elements of their transit systems to detect pedestrians and bicyclists. And they're using grant funding and trying to find more money to do the future. They want to implement all their buses. They're really excited about this. This has really reduced in their mind the potential for crashes with pedestrians and potential bicyclists. This is happening right now in PS Transit. And I think this is will happen more and more as we move forward. And so again, great opportunity to increase safety, reduce injuries in a different kind of way than perhaps that we think about. It's driver behavior, but it's also pedestrian behavior, but maybe we can sort of connect the both in a way that we communicate when the pedestrian runs across the roadway and the driver may not have the chance to brake unless he has a technology assist to do that. So again, that's a really great opportunity that's happening right now in Pierce County. Let's go to the next one. Another thing that Pierce Transit is doing right now, which is really exciting, you guys talked about transportation of children to schools or just, you know, we talked about low income or disadvantaged communities. It's not just, it's also disabled, the people who have other needs, special needs. They're really left out of the transportation system as we know it right now. There's a real equity issue. It's just not just the equity in getting driver's license. There's a huge equity issue. And so what can we do to use automation to really steer automation in a way that we as public administrators want it to happen? You know, we want to happen in a way that just benefits our citizens. And again, here's a great opportunity. Well, Lyft has a pilot project with Pierce Transit, again, to provide the, we call it, you know, first and last mile connections, which are really hard to do. So from your home to the transit center, you may not have a good connection, or the park and ride is constantly crowded. You cannot get a ride if you go there at 8. If you're not there at 6, you can't get a park spot or a park and ride. Or just that you don't have the ability to get your kid from point A to point B because you have to go to work. So this is getting a Lyft for a nominal fee. I think it's $2 or something they're charging right now. It's providing rides to the hubs, to the next, and also the other way around from the destination to the hub and the return. So you can see how this maybe would change your commute. Or those of you who are walking or bicycling, maybe in the wintertime you don't like to do so much of that. So maybe you might use a Lyft to connect and that might avoid you taking a trip. So again, here's opportunities. And again, I think that's in turn and also helping us figuring out how we provide some service to communities that normally are kind of left out of this process. And the other thing we're doing is looking at rural microtransit in the rural areas. Again, these can operate autonomously, but at this beginning, probably not. But again, those are smaller size shuttles who pick up people in a rural area where there's less density, you know, to justify a bigger transit service. Again, but giving that opportunity to make these connections is a very real opportunity right now. So I think I'm excited about that.
So Danielle, on the rural microtransit, that is... It's not doing anything for the paratransit that they have to get for disabled, well, but it's really more of a, but it could include them.
But if you think about the transit system's ability to maybe focus on paratransit
right.
only, like a dial lift or something
that is so expensive.
You really think of how expensive that could
right.
be, and maybe
right.
but they can maybe worry less about some of these less dense areas and
right.
leave that to the private sector or leave it to some other options that are cheaper. So you can see how that could
that's,
make a difference.
That's interesting.
Refocusing the service.
So much of our cost is getting someone from Morton to Centralia was a... That's a long daggone way in a bus that gets miles a gallon.
I am coming up now with a
van or something.
They're now relying on a special service now.
Mm-hmm.
And as a person that is now a family member assisting another family member trying to figure out how to get from point A to B, I have learned so much in the last 8 months that it just blows my mind how difficult it is to get to a doctor's appointment when you're in a wheelchair. So it's really, 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 all of that have become part of that population. The disadvantaged population, which I didn't think I was, but I am now because I have a family member. I need to get into a wheelchair. I need to get into an appointment in Tacoma because that's the only specialist that can see that person.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really difficult when that reality becomes your reality.
Yeah. Yes.
And Danielle, forgive me, we are out of time.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. So I don't know. I'm not sure how much more you have.
I think just a few more.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you.
I'm going to skip that. That's just the licensing. We talked about that. We're working with the AV Infrastructure System Subcommittee to identify some high priority policy needs, and they have identified some of those, and we're going to make a recommendation in our December meeting. Again, we've been working with all our stakeholders. We had 70 people in the room, 70 of them only at our first meeting. So there's a strong interest from the private sector, the public sector, to come together to figure this out. And then there's never been a slide that you get material for. The next one shows they're voted on. Pre-meeting, we asked them to pre-vote, so we had the idea where they want to go. Some of these pilot projects that are interested in undertaking kind of reflects again where we are as a state in looking forward to to try to make some of those things work. You know, and again, which ones of those nuggets are we going to work on? And so that's pretty much all I had to say. Sorry, I had to rush through a little bit here, but I hope it gives you enough sense of what's going on and it's really happening now, close to in the future. We're not talking about Jetsons flying around yet. Also, we talked about that too, by the way. I mean, it's very involved in unmanned, you know, transportation, but the reality is this is happening.
So it's the man from GLAAD backpack.
Yeah, there you go.
Jetpack, for those
and
of
I
us.
Have, I have something that I found that's really cute, but I'm not allowed to put it on the sculpture. It's not like my material, but I can kind of know. I think it talks about, you know, how do you predict the future when you don't, but you plan for it. You know, it's kind of miserable, but it's really need to think about it. And I would say, I want to encourage you to say in your organizations, I mean, you have small organizations, large organizations, you have organizations who are not equipped to do some of the stuff that Foshop may be able to do. But we only have two people, Ted and I, working on this, not like we have a whole staff there. Is that in your organization, maybe some people who are kind of innovation-focused, maybe have those folks added to their job description and look out into the future and see what they can do to see how they can bring along some other things that you're doing while you do your normal operations you do every day. And I think it could be maybe a quality of folks, could be a performance folks, could be maybe, or you know, I don't know, if somebody's interested in that topic and saying, how do we look out if these things are changing as we go, and how do we bring some of these things in, the knowledge, you know, the information.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay, all right.
Sorry. Thank you. One reason I wanted to bring Danielle over and is to share the thoughts that, you know, we as state agencies, as one as a commission agency with all the commissioners here, is, you know, they are swamped. They are overwhelmed with the number of requests that are coming in and really trying to provide really good, accurate information. Because, you know, you'll hear from the Boeing executive saying, we're going to have autonomous vehicles in 5 years. You hear from Tesla, no, it's already here. So the public's getting a lot of mixed messages. And so how do we actually help to message from our own is really what are we actually talking about with the automation? And really good. But those two are trying to cover 50 presentations in a 1 week presentation?
15 in like 3 weeks right now.
So is looking about as we move forward in your own organizations, do you have somebody that you would like maybe identify as a subject matter expert in autonomous vehicles? You know, I know DOT is creating that, I know we have the AV work group, but how do we help to offset that? Because there might be very specific things in audiences, like when licensure, or how is this going to affect public health? How can this improve the livability for those that may be unable to drive? Physically, they may be blind, they may have other physical limitations. So how will this open that up to allowing people to get transportation that maybe they just didn't have individually in the past? And also getting past the notion that we may not own our own cars. And something that's really interesting about this is this connected autonomous transportation thought is maybe we won't have individual car ownership in the future. Maybe we just think, you know, I don't need to own a car anymore, that kind of thing. So anyway, so can I just share a couple things from my report? Okay, that clock is actually 5 minutes fast. So since we started a few minutes late. I just wanted to just recognize, you know, we have so many great partners that work with us, with the commission, and we have amazing staff that are here and just really put their heart and souls into this work, because it may not be the most glamorous, it may not make the nightly news, but really what makes an impact in people's lives. And so Amy Davignon from the Department of Health has really been working with Angie and our bicycle advisory group, our pedestrian advisory group. Is there not a group that you don't work on? So I just wanted to recognize her and her great work. We've got some things that have come up on our new website. You have the card here with all the information, so you have access to this. Especially her work around young drivers, motor vehicle, crack. I'm just going to let you two just talk just 1 minute.
Sure. So in relation to the conversation we were having earlier, we have put parents in this country in a bit of a pickle, and that they are kind of the quarterback of their child's driver education team with hours that they're supposed to get behind the wheel with their teen. We just want to make that their lives easier. Shelley and I have had this conversation where it seems like every time we go anywhere, it's a parent with a teen driver or an almost teen driver saying, what do I do? So what Amy did is the Department of Health received a CDC grant, And one of the elements of that was motor vehicles and driver young driver specific. So she came to us and said, what should we do? And it was a beautiful, it's why our commission is such a great structure, and so many states would love to have it. So, you know, she had a project that was going to deal with young drivers. She came to us, and then we took the opportunity to create some materials that we haven't had the luxury of having that is really focused on parents. And then what we did is we created one of our new websites is focused on the user. So when someone clicks on a Facebook ad, they're going to take it to our new site, Wadrive to Zero, that is a resource for that person. And in this case, it's for parents. And what we're doing is bringing forward some of the information that's on the Department of Licensing website that's a little buried in the licensing section, and bringing that forward, things like the tool to help with what I do in those 50 hours, the tool to, how do I keep track of those 50 hours? What does a parent teen contract look like? And what is the IDL and how do I understand it? So it's just a little bit more. So we're doing a $10,000 media buy for Teen Driver Safety Week next week, and it looks different. It looks better because of our partnership with DOH and with Department of Licensing. So, thank you.
Commissioner Wiesman and Amy, you guys rock. Thank you very much, all of you. But I do appreciate the support that she gets from her leadership and the organization. So as Angie mentioned, you know, on your little at a glance, there's a few things here that I just want to make sure you're aware of. From the WTSC.wada.gov website that we have, all the elements that are there, the WTSCpartners.com, these are where you can actually go out and actually pull communication materials, ads, graphics, things if you're doing PowerPoints or anything like that, our high visibility enforcement patrols, our WashingtonDriveToZero.com, that's kind of for the public. But I want to make sure that you are all aware, these are all new services that we're providing and information that you can have just at a fingertip that you can grab if you had information, if you needed something. I just also wanted to share with you, as you know, on October 12th, Canada legalized cannabis across the federal system, and we were just at the International Association of Chiefs of Police, Chief Sass and I were, and in the Highway Safety Committee, Brad Blair, who's one of the commissioners in Canada, I think it's the Ontario Provincial Police, was giving a report out, and he said something that I was like, can law enforcement then now use cannabis in Canada? And the answer is yes. Can commercial vehicle carriers use cannabis? The answer is yes. Can airline pilots use cannabis now? The answer was yes. So what they are facing now is establishing now a fitness for duty. What does that look like? How long would they have to be clear? I mean, that's all. So for me, I'm not flying Air Canada. I pose that to you only as we have some interconnections with our neighbors to the north, and I don't know what impacts we will see, but my son was telling me on the way home from high school, or from school last night, he says, did you hear about that big marijuana farm that's on fire? There's thousands of people high in Canada. I was like, never heard of it. So, but, you know, well, good for them. Maybe we have the munchies. So the Canadian legalization, and I also, we have the 5 nanograms as far as the per se limit in this state. Oregon decided not to put one in. They decided really to leave it towards, you know, identifying impairment. And Colorado has a presumptive level where if it's presumed over 5 nanograms, it's very different. And the International Association of Chiefs of Police and the National Sheriff's Association have both put forward and approved resolutions to share with states and state legislatures is actually avoiding any type of a nanogram level because there is no science to support nanogram to impairment. So we're really looking at, because we're seeing some people that 2 and 3 nanograms are extremely impaired, and some that maybe at 10 because they're a long-time user that may show very little impairment. So I can share those with you, but that is something I think in the future we may want to explore is our 5 nanogram level even appropriate? And is it really almost, in some respects, undue or unfair for some people? So I think we need to really look at and assess that piece of it.
I think a lawyer could drive a truck through that.
What's that?
A lawyer, a good lawyer could just...
Well, and that's the problem is that they are.
Yeah.
And we're losing a lot of those cases.
Yeah.
And so, especially if they're under 5 nanograms, many of the cases are not even getting charged.
Right.
So, there's definite impairment.
Sure.
Another issue, I just want to make sure that you are all kind of on the forefront of your minds. With this connected transportation piece, we're seeing a lot of the new electric bicycles, like Lime and I think Bird. I think Lyft's getting involved with some things. And then you're seeing these electronic scooters. And we have seen, just nationally, Washington, D.C. just recently had an impaired scooter rider killed on one of those. So we've actually done some legal analysis with our folks here, with our traffic safety resource prosecutors, and looking at if somebody was actually on a scooter and they were operating it on a public roadway and hit a pedestrian like they did in Los Angeles, could they be charged for DUI or even a vehicular assault if there was enough damage? So there's some question that because we have a definition of motor vehicle and a definition of vehicle, is that in some respects bicycles do not count as. So those are some things we're looking at, but just be aware in some of the jurisdictions that you're starting to see this. We definitely want to see that technology and those options, but making sure that they're operating safely. Some vendors allow the riders to not be licensed. So if you're under the age of 16 and you want to rent one, you can. Some vendors require that you are licensed. There's one vendor that specifically says, do not operate this if you are under the influence, and some that do not have that. So, you know, so I know some of you are operating with counties and cities, and all of that is looking at and seeing when these technologies come in is, you know, what kind of contracts do they have, and as far as some of the definitions. So key elements that I think, just to be aware of, because we were just down in Atlanta, and it was a free-for-all. These people are on scooters, and they're cutting across traffic, and just like, man, do they have to follow the rules of the road? Or are they just, that's another challenge that we're going to have to
address. Well, they took that loophole and just dropped them.
What's that?
They took the loophole and just dropped them.
They have.
And Portland is just overrun. Raleigh is really overrun.
So, and I just mentioned, because we're all facing this, and then it's about, you know, if they are a motor vehicle, then how are they licensed? And then the operator, who can actually operate those? So I think these are challenging issues. And you look at health issues, too, with bicycles. Tacoma has taken them on, and they have found that the average trip for a bicycle is about 4/10 of a mile. And the scooter is 6/10 of a mile. So I think it's kind of new. It's kind of, hey, how is this going to work? Some people may think that they can handle those, and they get on them, and it's a little bit different. And so it could be a hazard. So just be
aware
of
those. Well, and not to mention there's no safety feature, you know, no bike helmet or anything like that available to the person.
Two things I just want to share with you is we went through a state audit. What was that? July? September? No, that was the mention review, but the other audit.
It was in August.
We haven't had a state auditor's office audit in almost 10 years. And so they came through very minor findings. One of them that we had was we didn't have certain report, you know, like a quarter report in the file. However, we had it on record in the system, but it just hadn't made it to the file. And I just share that with you because after all the, you know, what you go through in a state audit, very little things. Then we had a management review, which is really a federal audit. They call it a review. We call it an audit. And we came out really with no findings at this point. So I just wanted to let the commissioners know that the agency operates and follows the federal rules, state rules, regulations, all of that. So maintaining our integrity as an organization. And then, as you know, we had 565 fatalities last year with 536 fatal crashes. Right now through September, and I will preface this as preliminary, but we have had 26 fewer fatalities and 52 fewer fatal crashes as of right now through FARS. October's been a very bad month, particularly in King County.
King County's horrible.
We're not sure what's going on up there, but it has been really hard. And but I just want to let you know that we have seen, and we actually color code each month that we have been below the year to date. And every month this year, we have been below where we were last year, which is, I think, the first time I've seen in probably 4 years. So are we making a change? I'm too hesitant to say, but it is some good news despite too many people losing their lives in preventable crashes. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it back to you. Thank you for chairing.
Of course. Yeah, thanks for the good of the order. Now we'll adjourn.